history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some incredible stories waiting to be told, if we'll just show up with that willingness to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained. So often, we come away inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Our guest today lives in Clovis, California, where he's about to celebrate his 95th birthday. But there were days in World War II, including nearly 6 months as a prisoner of war, when the likelihood of his celebrating his 21st or 22nd birthdays was not exactly strong. I've been looking forward to bringing you Joe Soldo's story for a long time, and I'm really excited that we can finally do that here in the new year. I first met Joe when he was preparing to go on an honor flight to Washington, D.C. last year, and I was amazed by the uniqueness of his story. We've been privileged to meet dozens of ex-prisoners of war here on Hometown Heroes over the years, including some who survived the Bataan Death March in the Pacific, others who endured death marches of their own throughout Europe. Joe did a lot of marching as a prisoner too, and he bore witness to some of the most horrific and infamous scenarios throughout that devastating worldwide war. Despite the physical and emotional toll that being a prisoner of war can take, Joe would go on to earn degrees from Notre Dame and the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He met and married his wife, Betty. They started a family, and he enjoyed a long and successful career as a corporate and government accountant. For most of the years since, he never spoke too extensively about his time in captivity. 40 years after he was liberated, Congress created the Prisoner of War Medal for people like Joe who were forced to live in the absence of freedom. President Reagan signed that into law, but Joe never put in for the medal. It wasn't until 2018, 73 years after he tasted freedom again, that he would receive that medal, surprised by his children and his congressman, Devin Nunes. The medal is meaningful, but more so are the memories, which we have the privilege of exploring with Joe today. Well, let's start with your childhood, Joe. Tell me about what it was like growing up in Pennsylvania in the 20s and 30s.
Like, not much of anything. It was depression time. Everybody was poor. You know, living through it was not bad, but it was hard times.
During the depression, your dad would take a Twinkie with him to work?
Yeah, and bring half of it home for me as a little boy. So I waited for him to come.
And your parents were immigrants from where?
Yugoslavia.
And I'm just guessing that, you know, a 5, 8, 10, 12-year-old kid in the 20s and 30s has a little different experience from that age of kid today.
Oh, yeah.
What were the things you did to stay busy or stay occupied?
Well, I worked at the gas station. Huff's had a service station, and I worked there every night pumping gas. In those days, they had Texaco had a fancy uniform. So I wore a fancy uniform, sold gasoline, got a penny a gallon for me. On a good night, I could make maybe 50, 60 cents.
So you met the Andrews sisters while you were working for Mr. Huff?
Yep.
How'd that happen?
Well, I got paid in an envelope with the money in the envelope, and they wanted to sign and I said, why? He says, we're the Andrews sisters. We're going to Hollywood. We're going to be famous, she said.
While you were a prisoner later on, did you ever hear any of their music and remember that moment?
Oh, yeah, I did.
Did you tell your fellow prisoners that you met them?
Yeah.
Did they believe you?
Oh, I think so. Yeah.
And how old were you when you started working at that service station for Mr. Huff?
16, something like that.
But I understand that he had a big impact on your life.
Oh, yeah. Because I had no particular plans. I was going to go to work in a steel mill like my father. And he said, no, you can do a lot better than that. You can do anything you want. You're smart enough. And if you're willing to work.
So that kind of changed your idea in your own mind?
Oh, yeah.
And English is not your first language?
No, Croatian.
So in the home growing up?
We didn't speak English. We spoke Croatian.
Can you still do that? Could you still have the vocabulary?
Sure. Danas smo išli, neće, ali ne mogu da bime. We're going someplace today, but I don't know where.
Sounds like something that'll always come in handy. I was just wondering if you could say Happy New Year in Croatian.
No. Well, I don't. Veseli Nova Godina. Veseli Happy New Year. Veseli Nova Godina.
See, it all comes back to you. So you grow up speaking Croatian in the home, learn English in school, figure you're going to work in a steel mill like your dad, but Mr. Huff says there's something else out there. And then 1941, you're 17 years old, and all of a sudden something happened that changed everything. And every veteran I've talked to seems to remember December 7th and how he found out. Do you remember how you heard about Pearl Harbor?
I guess it was just over the radio that I heard it.
Was that a big deal?
Oh, yeah, a very big deal.
Did it make you wonder if the service would be part of your future?
Yes, it did. I wondered about it.
And you turned 18 the next month.
Yeah. I had a full year of engineering that I studied on my own at Lehigh University.
So ASTP was a great deal for a lot of people because it promised you can go to college while you're fulfilling your service requirements. And all these college campuses were all of a sudden, you know, filled with military personnel. And you did yours in Boston?
Yeah. Boston was a very good place to be in uniform at that time. They treated their servicemen very well. You couldn't buy it. You go into a place to eat something, somebody always picks up the tab. Mm-hmm. It was nice.
And you were studying engineering there?
Yes.
So it sounds like you got a whole year in then, and then in your second year they said ASTP is no more, we need troops?
That's right.
And how'd you feel about that?
Well, I didn't much care for it, but you go along, you know.
Yeah, actually, I'm reading here in something that you wrote years ago. You said you were one sad guy, and for the first time in your life, you got completely drunk.
Oh, but yeah, that's right. That's right. They canceled the ASTP program. That's the only time in my life when I ended up in New York, and I don't know how.
And then they take you to Fort Knox and put you in the 78th Infantry Division. How was that adjustment? Did you get to know some of those guys?
Oh, yeah. It was a good way to do it, to train as a unit, as a division, and we did. And it was a good way to do it.
Did they challenge you a little bit? Because, I mean, you'd been basically a college student for the last couple of years.
If a sergeant came out the first day, he's saying, "Oh, you guys go to college?" He says, "You think you go to, you're smart." He said, "You're a four-letter word ending in T. You're nothing."
And from what I understand, you started to figure out you were a pretty good shot?
What, with a rifle? Yeah, I was an expert. They had the first rifle that came out, the M1. It was a very good rifle. You could hit a beer can at 100 yards pretty easy with reasonable eyesight, and at that time I could.
Well, how'd you feel about this idea of going overseas and fighting?
Well, I didn't have any idea. This is what you had to do to serve your country, and I just did it. Didn't give it any thought.
Did you have a sense of what it was like for your parents to see you go?
Oh, yeah. They were very sorry to see me go, my mother particularly, because she was in Europe during World War I and saw some of the carnage that war can come.
I'm sure she had those visions of something like that happening to you.
Yeah. And in fact, when I came home, first thing she did was felt my legs, see if I had all... Really, see if I had my legs.
Well, and the other thing I noticed in reading some of your memoirs, it seems like the Catholic faith was a big part of your existence, too.
Oh, yeah. When I went to Notre Dame, it was an all-male school. It was a Catholic university.
And you had to go through some pretty wild things to make it to Notre Dame after the war. Let's talk about heading over. Did you go to England first and train some more?
Yes, well, we went to the Cliffs of Dover. They threw the nets there, and we practiced climbing the nets with a rifle and with a full duffel bag. It's pretty high climb.
Makes you wonder what's next, I bet.
Yeah.
Well, and how long was it before you got that first taste of war, what combat was really like?
Well, the first day, we were moving forward, and my best buddy was a Yale student, got hit in the middle of the forehead and killed as we walked along.
How do you deal with that? I mean, you're a 20-year-old kid.
This is war. You deal with it, you know. There's just no other way to say it than, you know, it's there and that's it.
You said he was your best buddy.
Yeah.
What do you remember about him?
Well, we used to go out once in a while together. That's about all.
I bet you can still see his face.
Yeah, yeah.
And here you're turning 95 years old. Have you ever wondered what he would have done with these last 75 years?
No, never thought of that.
You said he was a Yale student. Sure, he would have had a bright future.
Yeah, oh yeah. He's been pretty sharp.
When you see something like that, and that's your first day of combat, and your best buddy gets killed right by you, does that make you wonder if you're next?
No. The heat of battle is confusion, noise. No, you don't have time to mull these things over.
You were in an infantry platoon, a rifle squad, or what?
Yeah, yes, rifle squad.
So how would you explain what your role in a battle would be?
Well, just move forward. Malmedy massacre, I remember, marching along and then coming to a field where about 41 American prisoners were shot. They were all dead. Instead of taking the prisoners back, and they would eventually end in the United States, this guy just shot them.
And you actually came across that scene?
Oh, yeah. And when he got out of jail, he was murdered immediately.
You're talking about Joachim Peiper, who commanded the outfit that perpetrated that atrocity near Malmedy, Belgium on December 17, 1944, and also carried out similar slaughters of prisoners around that area. Peiper served 12 years in prison for war crimes, but worked under a different name in France after his release. He was killed, as Joe said, when his identity was revealed. That was in 1976. So many have heard about the Malmedy massacre, and we've heard from veterans on this show who also witnessed it, even one who escaped from those very same SS troops. But Joe, this was shortly after you were captured, which we're going to talk about in a bit, and you actually witnessed that scene with your 20-year-old eyes.
The bodies were there.
And you guys knew immediately what happened, or you learned later?
No, you knew immediately what happened.
Does that make you angry? Does it make you scared? What does that do to you?
I don't know.
Sure is hard to imagine witnessing that ourselves, isn't it? It's time for our first break, but there's so much more to come with soon-to-be 95-year-old Joe Soldo of Clovis, California, including the details of his capture, the day of his liberation, and you'll hear about one of his prized possessions. I don't think you're going to find this item anywhere else. That's the subject of a few photos and even a video of Joe online at hometownheroesradio.com and also on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity University of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.